Welcome to The Warcast, your geopolitical briefing that tells you what you need to know, when you need to know it. The Warcast is for War on the Rocks members only. Spread the word and tell your friends and colleagues to sign up at warontherocks.com/subscribe.
With so much happening in the past few weeks, I thought it would be useful to take stock of where things are with this week's summit in Singapore between the United States and North Korea. My guest today is Dean Cheng, Senior Research Fellow for Chinese Political and Security Affairs at the Heritage Foundation. Welcome to the Warcast, Dean.
Thank you for having me.
It's our pleasure. Let's talk through first about each side's bargaining positions. You know, what is the U.S.'s position and what does success look like?
Well, the U.S. position has been consistent across four administrations. It is the complete, verifiable, irreversible denuclearization of North Korea, which translates to North Korea has to get rid of its nuclear weapons, its nuclear weapons-grade material, and its reprocessing facilities and ability to basically manufacture future weapons. There's also been some discussion about also wanting North Korea to give up its ICBMs, which can threaten the United States, and ideally its intermediate, medium, and short-range ballistic missiles, which allow it to pound South Korea and Japan.
All right. And for North Korea, you know, what is their position here? What are they looking to get out of these talks?
That's a tough one. So North Korea has talked about denuclearization. But when the North Koreans talk about denuclearization, it typically means something rather different. It means that the United States, one, has to cease targeting North Korea with nuclear weapons. And there it's important to remember that the U.S. nuclear deterrent was probably a key reason why North Korea signed the armistice back in 1953. Second, the United States needs to withdraw its nuclear deterrent umbrella from South Korea. Third, the U.S. needs to end its military commitment conventionally to South Korea. And then there's been discussion of wanting the U.S. to basically pull its nuclear forces away from the Korean Peninsula, which, depending on how the North Koreans want to define that, could even mean something having to do with our ballistic missile submarines. So that's the nuclear aspect. We think, and of course we can't be sure, that some of the other things North Korea would hope to get out of all this is sanctions relief, being able to be seen as a quote-unquote normal country, which would mean the elimination of other restrictions on trade, technology transfer, et cetera, to North Korea, perhaps a line of credit, and eventually probably some kind of peace treaty. So a very short, easy-to-meet list of demands.
Yeah, indeed. So let's flip that around a little bit. What is each side, or what do you assess each side is willing to give up to get the things that it wants out of the other?
I think with the North Koreans, we don't really know, but almost certainly not nuclear capabilities, for a variety of reasons. North Korea's nuclear capabilities are the result of Kim Jong-il's efforts. He was the nominal head of the nuclear weapons development program. Kim Jong-il, of course, is Kim Jong-un's father. So giving up dad's hallmark achievement would be difficult under the best of circumstances. Its nuclear capability has been written into the North Korean constitution. North Korea has even demanded being viewed as a nuclear weapons state, essentially equivalent to the P5. It also is a deterrent against potential enemy attack, meaning the United States. And at the end of the day, it also gives them a cudgel to pressure South Korea and Japan. So realistically, we're probably not going to see much from North Korea, especially once we get into the details of how they would denuclearize and how irreversible it would have to be. For the United States, the promises that have been laid out already include positive security assurances, meaning we say we are not going to try and change your regime or invade you. We have offered some relief on some sanctions. We have indicated we might be willing to cooperate with the South Koreans with regards to further future investments, meaning we would not stand in the way if South Korea were to invest, and they're the most likely investor. So those are just sort of the initial offering positions. So in theory, if North Korea actually gave up all of its nuclear weapons and capabilities, the United States could, in theory, basically open up the floodgates of investment, money, and resources.
Given these two positions, and it sounds like there's a bit of a gap between what each side is going to be looking to get and give up, is there a win set where both leaders could walk away with some level of agreement and say, well, we had some success? What would such a win set, a most likely win set, look like?
Well, to begin with, if the summit actually comes off, and we're still a couple hours away and anything could happen, but if the summit comes off, that is a win for both sides. It is the first time that the head of North Korea and the head of the United States have actually met since the founding of North Korea back in 1945. It is a significant advance from even just a week or two ago when everyone thought the summit wasn't even going to happen. If the two can hold some kind of joint press conference and basically say, we have agreed on the shape of the table and that the world is round, that's still more than has ever occurred between the United States and North Korea. After that, one could imagine that the two sides agree to continue to talk, probably not at the president-to-president level, president-to-supreme leader level, but instead probably their chief principals and under. You could imagine very drawn-out negotiations have to do with denuclearization. North Koreans would love that. But others might see that as stabilizing on behalf of the West. Probably not a peace treaty, almost certainly not a denuclearization agreement. All of those are unlikely to occur.
Let's talk a little bit about preparation for the summit, at least on the side of the United States, because I don't imagine we have a lot of insight to what was going on in Pyongyang. There were a number of reports last week, and some inferences made just by statements by the president himself, that the administration is not exactly fully prepared for these talks, and that a lot of it's going to be dependent upon the personal interaction between Kim and Trump. Does that strike you as true? And what are the possible consequences of engaging in these high-level talks without the typical preparations, assuming that the statements are true?
Well, I'm not really sure what a typical preparation would look like for something like this. I mean, the closest equivalent would be Nixon going to China. And that, of course, involved an enormous amount of backstory. But at the end of the day, you had ping pong diplomacy, you had Kissinger going to China, you had various discussions and the like. So on the one hand, what would be a template world model? Another part to this is one would hope that our intelligence community has been preparing reports and things about North Korea, Kim Jong-un, Kim Jong-chol, all of the various North Korean leaders, North Korea's economic situation, political situation, et cetera, on a day-to-day basis for the last 60 years. So what additional preparation would be required from the ICE, from the intelligence community? I don't know. Now, where this becomes an interesting problem is how much has Mr. Trump read? How prepared is he to deal with the North Koreans? And let's be honest, I don't think any American president has, quote unquote, been ready to deal with Kim Jong-un or Kim Jong-il simply because it hasn't happened. And then most important is laying out in their own minds, what am I willing to give up? What do I want? How hardball am I willing to go to get what we want without giving them necessarily everything they want? In that regard, Mr. Trump might actually be pretty good at this. He has done a lot of negotiating. The interesting thing for the North Koreans is going to be that he is different from any other American negotiator they've dealt with. He's not Wendy Sherman. He's not Aunt Madeleine Albright. He is a businessman by training, which has strengths and which has weaknesses. I do want to take a second here, though, and talk a little bit about possible North Korean preparations. Can we do that?
Please do.
So one of the interesting things is who is coming to this summit from the North Korean side. We have, of course, Kim Jong-un. That goes without saying. But we also have his sister, and we have Kim Jong-chol, his senior advisor, which means that we really have the nucleus of North Korea's absolute top leadership, all out of the country, all in Singapore at the same time. That says something about how seriously the North Koreans are taking this. It says something about what they may be willing to think about in terms of negotiating approach and tactics. If this was simply going to be a photo op, you didn't have to bring all of these people. It may be intended purely as a signal to his own internal politics. I am stable and strong enough, and my grip on power is firm enough. Yeah, I can take the whole family down to Singapore, and we're good. So I think that's, there's a whole lot of interesting, you know, backstory there that, you know, if we had a better understanding of North Korea, would probably help us get a sense of where they're coming from.
At the risk of ending this on a bit of a pessimistic note, my last question is, you know, this, within the American press, at least, has been a lot of speculation on all the things that could go horribly wrong during the summit. In your opinion, what is the worst case scenario that could come out of these talks?
Let me start with actually post summit. Kim Jong-un, as far as we know, has never traveled this far since he took leadership. He certainly never traveled on such a predictable schedule. We know when he is in Singapore. We probably know when he is returning home. So if there was some nascent embryonic anti-Kim Jong-un element within North Korea, it might emerge during or after this summit. And that could introduce just simply incalculable elements of instability. Imagine if they actually tried to kill him. Imagine if they succeed in killing him. Imagine if they try to kill him and don't succeed, and then he purges everyone or decides that, you know, he obviously cannot trust anyone in his own system. You know, the elimination of three senior military leaders just before the summit suggests that something is still volatile in their system. So whatever emerges from the summit, that's my biggest worry, actually, is what happens afterwards in North Korea. For the summit itself, I think that certainly one terrible possibility would be if the North Koreans are perceived as not serious and, you know, President Trump simply gets up and walks out and flies home. That is certainly going to be seen as destabilizing. It's certainly going to be elevating fears of war throughout the region. I fear what might happen if the North Koreans come away with the wrong sense of either the American commitment to South Korea or South Korea's willingness to stand up for itself. We're not talking about appeasement here. We're talking about miscalculation. And finally, and this is not so much a worst case as just what we don't know, is what does Beijing think about this whole business? And what does Moscow think about this whole business? I find it fascinating that Kim Jong-un flew to Singapore aboard a Chinese commercial aircraft, an A330. What does that say about the relationship between North Korea and China? Was this China offering a, you know, olive branch to North Korea to curry favor? Was this a sign that he, you know, North Korea had to basically go and plead for transportation from China? And what does Xi Jinping do in the wake of this to exploit whatever opportunity has arisen?